You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Presidential candidates ranging from Bernie Sanders to Ted Cruz have made a point of saying that economic inequality is a problem. And so have two former Fed chairmen, Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke. Since Thomas Piketty's published his book, Capital in the 21st Century, last year, everybody's been talking about inequality. But inequality of what? Are certain kinds of inequality more harmful, and by how much? Is some inequality more unequal than others? Can some actually be good, even necessary for society? In addition to their work at the University of Michigan, economists Susan Donarski and Justin Wolfers often discuss inequality and related economic issues in the New York Times Upshot section, and I'm pleased to welcome them to our show now. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
35 years ago, Nobel Prize-winning economist and a philosopher Amartya Sen asked, equality of what? How do economists answer? You want to start, Susan?
Sure. I mean, income inequality tends to be what we focus on as economists. Income is what we turn into food and rent and all the other things that we actually get benefits from. And that's, I think, what the conversation has been about in the U.S. My own work focuses actually on inequality of education, who goes to college, who doesn't go to college. And this relates to income inequality because education is one of the key vehicles to get from being poor to getting to the middle class or being rich. So it's more about income mobility than income inequality, and the two ideas are pretty closely related.
Well, Sen advocates what's called a capabilities approach rather than discussion of equality of income or wealth or opportunity. Are you familiar what he means by that?
I haven't read it closely, but I think the idea is that you have essentially an equality of opportunity to do what you want to do. That would be that children are given the abilities to make it where they want to. But correct me if I'm wrong.
I'm not going to correct you. You're the economist here. Justin, don't questions about inequality involve moral issues that many economists prefer to avoid?
We can't avoid them. All economic policies have distributional consequences. And so you're absolutely right to say that economists sometimes we do draw a distinction between positive and normative analysis, you know, saying what will happen versus what should happen. But in any time you're trying to evaluate any public policy, there will be implications that need you to think through a moral lens.
Some inequality became a headline issue. Much of the debate is focused on disparities in wealth or income. What's the difference between wealth and income inequality?
So wealth is a stock. Income is the money you're earning each year, and wealth is how it all adds up.
Is one more important than the other?
So they're more difficult to collect data on. So lots of people argue, and I think quite reasonably, that we should pay a lot more attention to wealth inequality. It could be that you didn't earn a lot of income last year because you're retired, but if you're living in a $5 million house, we should go ahead and call you wealthy rather than poor. The difficulty is wealth is much, income we can measure fairly easily. Let's look at your tax returns, for instance. I'll just ask you. Wealth is much more difficult. How do we value your house? How do we value your car? What about your jewelry? And then there are other forms of wealth, or things that we as economists would call wealth, that you may disagree with. For instance, Sue studies education and the number of years you've got of education. It's incredibly valuable education, and it helps you earn more income. You could think about that as a form of wealth, or you might not. So there are sometimes some slippery definitional issues. But it does turn out that inequality in wealth is much greater than inequality in income.
Susan, I wanted to follow up on that. People talk about equality of income, wealth, opportunity, education, representation, mobility, liberty, race, gender, dignity, resources, happiness. How can we get a handle on all that?
Well, I will say that when we do have good data about wealth and income, in the few surveys that collect both, wealth tends to be a good measure of whether you've had a good income your whole life and whether your parents did and whether your grandparents did. So, for example, if you look at blacks and whites who have very similar income, you tend to see that they have very different wealth. The whites have more in the way of wealth. There's a recent post that David Leonhardt did in the New York Times that looked at differences in the types of neighborhoods that blacks versus whites lived in. People with the same income, the blacks are much more likely to live in poorer neighborhoods. Again, that's a sign of their lower wealth. So, you know, if you're thinking of sort of intergenerational inequality, wealth tends to be a better measure of it. But as Justin points out, we have a harder time measuring it.
Deirdre McCloskey and others argue that if everybody is experiencing some economic improvement, then it doesn't matter that inequality is growing. What's your view on that? Is that the same argument as a rising tide raises all boats?
It is, and it's what, say, the 60s looked like in the United States. And what we have right now is that only the big boats at the top are rising. Real incomes at the bottom of the distribution, even the middle of the distribution, have been dropping for some time. And so in terms of the politics of what the inequality means, it certainly has a very different flavor when all the boats are rising versus when only the yachts are going up.
And last year, Forbes reported that the 400 wealthiest Americans have combined wealth well over $2 trillion, as much as the entire GDP of Brazil. Can inequality or wealth concentration be so great that it's bad in itself because it's unfair? Do you want to answer? Well, do you want to answer that at all, Justin? Or is that a rhetorical question?
No, I think there are two reasons to care about it. There are many reasons to care about inequality, but two frames for thinking about it. So one is, what are the direct consequences? I'm pretty confident that an extra dollar in the hands of a trillionaire makes less of a difference to that person than, a homeless person on the streets of New York City. And so I think that those inequities, that inequality, just means we're actually getting less bang for our buck. The dollars are in the wrong hands. They're in hands that don't make a big difference. There's a second reason, which is you might worry that actually this could end up distorting our economics or our politics. This is where economists start to wave our hands a little bit more, and partly collecting good evidence on this is difficult. But, you see right now the Republican primaries, and the most important thing right now is to line up the really big contributors. And so this could distort our politics in quite important ways. It could also distort the economy and others, that if so much of the investment capital is with few people, maybe that actually restricts opportunity. And so there are a bunch of ways in which inequality can actually then actually prevent the pie as a whole growing as fast as we might want it to.
And some, like Simon Johnson, have talked about an oligarchy in the United States. What do you think? Could inequality be so great that democracy might be threatened?
I think we're actually seeing that today, the role that the Koch brothers are playing in politics, the so-called Adelson primary, where we have people all over, we have some of our leading politicians rushing to Las Vegas to meet with one particular person, and in some cases changing their policies so that they are more sympathetic to those who have the largest, can make the biggest difference to their campaign purses. Now, the good news is, as we move towards the general election, mums and dads are going to be a bigger part of campaign donations. And that's an offsetting force and a useful force. But as income becomes increasingly concentrated, we should worry about the effects of the oligarchs.
My guests are Justin Wolfers and Susan Donarski, both of the University of Michigan and also both of the New York Times. We're talking about the different guises of inequality. Well, how well do voters' choices reflect their economic interests in the U.S.? Voters in Kansas reelected Sam Brownback despite claims from members of his own party that his policies have harmed the state.
I think it's a difficult question, and you've got to give a degree of. So I certainly know that the book "What's the Matter with Kansas," where people in the middle class are voting against their economic interests. But I think we also need to give voters some credit, which is economics is not the only thing that matters, and they're often looking for candidates whose views are consistent with their morality or other issues, and I do think that's important. But all of that said, there is a puzzle in the U.S. why the general public has been complacent as the economy has drifted towards giving a larger and larger share of the pie to a smaller and smaller number of people. We've sometimes seen people push back against that, the Occupy movement, but it never really took hold, for instance, in the way that, say, the Tea Party has. So I think there is a deep puzzle there.
We saw a great example of this, actually, earlier this year, where the president was proposing to eliminate a tax break that primarily benefits very rich households in the U.S. It's the 529 plans that are college savings plans, and they disproportionately benefit people with very high tax rates and very high incomes. And he was proposing to eliminate that break to fund free college, free community college. And there was a huge backlash, including among people who really don't benefit from these at all, but they have sort of the impression that they do. And this links up with longstanding statistics in the U.S. that show that the overwhelming majority of people identify as middle class. Few people identify themselves as working class. Even if you looked at the income measures, their position, that's what they are. So we haven't had much of a class-based conversation in the U.S., and I think that tends to undermine our discussions and our policy, redistributive policies.
Whenever it's brought up, there are claims that we're engaging in class warfare. But some research has suggested that Americans get more conservative and more resistant to redistribution as inequality increases. Isn't that counterintuitive?
It is counterintuitive, and it is true that over a period of time, several decades in which inequality has increased, you might have thought that the demand for redistribution would increase, and one of the big political science puzzles has been why it hasn't.
Higher taxes on the wealthy is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Or yeah, sometimes that, and also policies that help people at the bottom, the social safety net. Should we have a less porous social safety net? And it is one of the big puzzles. Why that hasn't materialized. Now, one question, and this is true in all of social sciences, we don't know what would have happened if inequality hadn't increased. And it may be that the counterfactual is that there would be even less demand for redistribution, for instance.
Several studies have found that social mobility has declined. Susan, is that a more important issue than inequality?
I think in the U.S., maybe in all countries, people tend to be more comfortable with a given level of inequality if they feel that people have a shot of at getting from the bottom to the top. You know, so yes, there's a lot of inequality, but everyone's got a chance to grab that golden ticket, and that's social mobility. And the evidence indicates that at least one key vehicle for social mobility, which is education, is pretty well stalled. So the latest statistics on college graduation indicate that if you come from the poorest set of households, you only have a 14% chance of getting a BA, and it's 60% if you're from the top income groups. So, I mean, that indicates that, you know, getting a BA is not a way for kids to get out of poverty, largely, and that's disturbing.
In 2012, economist Alan Krueger described what he called the Great Gatsby Curve. What did he find?
It's a really interesting observation. What he finds is when you look across countries, those countries with the highest degrees of income inequality, that is differences between rich and poor, also tended to be those with the lowest levels of mobility. So you were less likely to move from having poor parents to being rich in the next generation. But I think it's economically powerful and also rhetorically very powerful. A lot of the debate in the U.S. is a debate between folks who would advocate for equality of outcomes, so less income inequality, versus others who really think the issue is inequality of opportunity, which you might think of as mobility. Every baby has the same chance to join the middle class, for instance. And what Krueger's curve shows is that those countries that do well on inequality also do well on mobility. And so the difference in the debate between inequality of opportunity and inequality of outcome, I think, turns out to be not as large as people tend to think. You do well on one, you'll do well on the other.
We're talking about the different guises of inequality with Justin Wolfers and Susan Donarski of University of Michigan, economists there, also contributors to the New York Times. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, Susan, we will talk about education. And Justin, we'll talk about some work that you and your wife, Betsy Stevenson, who's also an economist, now serves on the President's Council of Economic Advisors, talk about the connection between wealth and happiness. Stay with us for more. We are back with University of Michigan economists Susan Donarski and Justin Wolfers, who often discuss inequality and related economic issues in the New York Times Upshot section. Susan, as you pointed out, you've done a lot of work on education. What are some of the most important trends in your view, and what can be done to improve things?
Well, a significant trend we see in the U.S. is that more and more people are going to college. About half of people drop out of college. But behind that, lots of inequality. So, as I mentioned earlier, about four times as likely to get a BA if you are from a high-income family as from a low-income family.
Now, let me stop you for a second. Do they drop out of college because they find it difficult or because of economic reasons?
Yes. I mean, it appears to be a mix of the degree of preparation they get before school and also costs. But even if you look at kids who are in high school have very similar educational outcomes, have similar test scores, you still see big gaps between the rich and poor kids in their graduation rates. So if you focus on kids who had, you know, were the top 25% of test scores while they're in high school, 74% of the rich kids will go on and get a degree, but only 21% of the poorer kids. So even if you focus on the kids with the best preparation, there's a huge gap. And there's a lot of research trying to understand this. It's a mix of the cost of college, getting sufficient supports in college. If you're a kid whose parents didn't go to college, you don't know which college you should go to, which courses to take, how to navigate the whole process. So it doesn't seem like there's one silver bullet, but a whole set of barriers for these kids.
Is there consensus on some of the other things that might have an important effect? Class size, teacher pay, home environment?
You mean in terms of their K-12 experiences?
Yes.
You know, because you've got problems all along the pipeline, essentially. No, there's not a consensus on again, there's no silver bullet whether you're looking at elementary and secondary or whether you're looking at post-secondary. All the way along the line, we've identified policies that work well to close gaps in preparation for college and gaps in college graduation rates. You know, the kids who enter college from the poorest families are about twice as likely to drop out even once they get to college. So getting them into college is not the one solution. They seem to need support all the way through.
There's been a debate over how good an investment college is. Is the investment in a very expensive elite university as good as or better than going to a public school?
There's, even within public schools, there's a lot of variation in quality. So a young person who goes to a flagship four-year university is more likely to actually get their BA than somebody who, say, starts out at a community college. So the quality of the institution matters quite a bit. But we have excellent public institutions, you know, University of Michigan, University of Virginia, Berkeley, UCLA, as well as excellent private institutions. Only about 20% of college students go to private institutions that cost the most. There are a lot of excellent public options.
Most American college students are at public schools, 40% in community colleges. In January, President Obama announced a $60 billion initiative to provide 2 years of community college for free. How effective do you think that could be?
I think college costs are a piece of the puzzle, but the evidence we've got indicates that even making college completely free does not eliminate the gaps in educational attainment. So there's just a lot more about going to college and succeeding in college than paying the tuition bill. It helps, But, you know, there's a great program that the CUNY carried out in its community colleges, and it seemed to double the share of students who actually got through their 2-year degrees with some alacrity. And the main part of that was not financial supports in the form of tuition, but it was intensive advising. It was also providing free books. But it was giving people priority and registration. It was sort of a wraparound set of services that seemed to do the job. So I think what we don't want to end up with is thinking that there is one policy that's the silver bullet, and that tends to be that's the tendency in politics and in policy is to look for a silver bullet, and I don't think there is one. There needs to be sustained attention to the problem.
Costs have even gone up in public universities like the one the two of you teach at, Michigan.
That's right.
Cornell political scientist Suzanne Mettler has called college the great unleveler, arguing that higher education policy is promoting inequality. Has government policy hindered some college students?
Disinvestment from our public institutions, I think, has made it difficult for poor kids. I mean, you mentioned that our tuition prices have gone up so sharply at public institutions. That's not because it costs more today to educate a kid at a public school than it did 10 or 20 years ago, but because states have stopped paying their part of those costs. So it's gotten shifted to students. And this means more expensive tuition, but it also means larger classes. It's tougher to register. It's tougher to get through that degree. So I would say that government's disinvestment from public institutions is causing problems.
And then there are the scandals at some for-profit colleges. How much of an impact is that having?
It's having a very strong impact on a minority of students. So I think this is actually very closely related to the disinvestment from the public institutions. What we've seen is that in places where states don't invest in their community colleges and students are looking for an education, they get pulled into the for-profit schools. So I think we created this problem. They end up at the for-profit schools with very high debt loads. If you look at the very high student debts, it tends to be disproportionately among the students who've gone to these for-profit institutions. So I think we made this problem, and the way to unmake it is to better support community colleges so that they can provide the education that these students are searching for.
We're talking about the different guises of inequality with Susan Donarski and Justin Wolfers of the University of Michigan, also contributors to the New York Times. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Justin, I mentioned earlier that you've worked with your wife, Betsy Stevenson, on the connection between wealth and happiness. What have you found?
So the connection is actually pretty simple, and it's probably pretty much what everyone, particularly economists, would have guessed, which is people with more income are happier. And there are people who had thought that maybe after some point extra money doesn't make a difference, but we can't find much evidence of that. And we've looked in poor countries, we've looked in rich countries, we've looked around the world. The interesting thing, the important thing I should say for the purposes of this conversation is a 10% rise in income yields the same rise in happiness for just about everyone all over the world. So to raise the income of a poor person by 10% doesn't require a lot of dollars, and that would increase happiness by as much as if we raise the income of a rich person by 10%. And so what this, of course, suggests is if we were to redistribute from the rich to the poor, the rich don't really need those extra dollars that much, and so their happiness wouldn't go down. You could redistribute to a whole lot more poor people, and their happiness might go up a fair bit.
But it seems that for some people, the money itself is the good, and that there's never enough money, and they'll work very hard to affect government policy so that they can get more money.
Absolutely. And this is consistent with what we've found, which is that people earning $200,000 are happier than people earning $100,000, are happier than people earning $50,000. Now, I would like to say that I knew what the difference between earning $100 million and $200 million is, but fortunately, there are sufficiently few people out there on those sorts of incomes that it's basically unknowable. But as far as we can tell, it looks like more money, more happiness, and that's true all the way up the distribution.
But can we really measure happiness? One person is happy herding cattle in Idaho. Another prefers crunching numbers on Wall Street.
Yeah, so the way we measure happiness is the world's simplest thing, which is we just go and ask people on a scale of 1 to 10, how satisfied are you with your life overall, or some question. like that. Now, you're right, Leonard, lots of people have this view that, like, well, I'm happy doing my current job, but if I were a goat farmer in a poor country, I would be just as happy. It's the sort of thing that rich liberals like to believe. It just turns out not to be true. It turns out that poor people in poor countries actually are living lives that involve a whole lot more anxiety, stress, worry, pain, and a lot less happiness.
And poorer people spend a lot of time doing drudge work. But the New Economics Foundation compiles a Happy Planet Index in which the United States apparently ranks 105th, far behind troubled countries like Pakistan and Syria.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's an index that has far greater rhetorical value than scientific value. So what they do is they try and measure how much happiness there is, and then they decide that they'll divide it by the, I think it's carbon emissions or some other measure of environmental footprint. If the question is which countries are happier than others, the U.S. is one of the happiest countries in the world. It's also one of the richest countries in the world. There are countries that are happier. Norway is happier, for instance. It's in many of these surveys the happiest country in the world. But and generally, the further you go down the income distribution, the Indians are less happy than we are, and people in Burundi and sub-Saharan Africa are even less happy again.
Is there one area like healthcare or housing or education where aid for the less well-off tends to have the greatest effect?
That turns out to be just a very difficult question to provide a particularly compelling answer. What we do know is among the industrialized countries, many of the Nordic countries turn out to be happier than the rest. Now, you could say, oh, that's because, you know, living in snow is terrific, but a different and I think more intuitive explanation would be these are countries that have better social welfare nets. And the social safety net may well mean that people live lives with far less stress, far less worry, and as a result, somewhat more happiness.
You recently wrote on estimates of the gross domestic product from the Bureau of Economic Analysis saying there's reason for reduced pessimism. What's happening?
So the economy, this is just a different question here, which is the U.S. economy is growing.
But not equally. The unemployment rate for African Americans is twice as high as that for whites and has been for decades.
Absolutely. One of the best things we know for getting the unemployment rate down, and particularly for getting the African-American unemployment rate down, is continued economic growth. And it turns out that the economy is on currently a record expansion. We've had more months, I think it's 52 now months, of consecutive job growth than we've actually ever had in U.S. history. And so this is an economic recovery which has been long. It's been slower than most of us might like, but it's been steady, and we have succeeded in getting the unemployment rate down to 5.5%. I for sure would like to see it go even further, and I think that we do have the capacity to push the unemployment rate down further, and I think that's one of the things that will be particularly successful in helping those at the bottom of the income distribution.
Could and should the Federal Reserve Board commit to a full employment policy, and what would a commitment like that look like?
Well, Congress has already made that decision for them. Congress has said that one of their objectives is to promote maximum employment. That's their job. It's also to make sure that we don't have too much inflation along the way and also make sure that we have financial stability. But if you ask Janet Yellen what her job is, she would describe getting to full employment as absolutely central to it. And that's exactly why debates at the Fed right now are so difficult, which is the question is how much further can we go without potentially overheating the economy.
Susan, we don't have a lot more time, but getting back to education, here in New York City, there's been a lot of debate over charter schools. And I'm wondering about how consistent the findings have been. Do some studies find one thing while others find the opposite?
What we have found is that in urban areas and among low-income, non-white populations, charter schools have been doing a better job than the traditional public schools that are the options for their students. So what looks inconsistent is that if you look in the suburbs, for example, and among more advantaged kids, the charter schools don't seem to be doing much. But for the target population, I would argue that the charter schools were created for, they do appear to be doing a pretty good job. Harlem Children's Own schools, for example, charter schools in Boston have been making some amazing strides with disadvantaged kids.
A caller comments that administrative costs have gone up in colleges, which is another cause for higher tuition costs. College presidents are making in many millions of dollars in many cases.
There are anecdotes out there, but the overall evidence is that basically, as I said earlier, the cost of college has of producing, you know, a college degree has not gone up, but the costs have been shifted on to students and away from institutions.
Now, there are conservatives who would say that inequality is just part of the human condition. Do economists agree with that?
I would be surprised if conservatives agreed with that, actually.
You've never heard that?
That it's a fact of life that we could do nothing about? No. I think the principled conservative argument would be that the costs of trying to reduce it don't outweigh the benefits. That's certainly what I hear from the conservatives I talk to in Washington.
Well, let's hope that we can see a time when inequality is reduced. Right now, we seem to be moving in the opposite direction, and government policies seem to be encouraging that. But we have to end this conversation, unfortunately. We've been talking about the different guises of inequality with Susan Donarski and Justin Wolfers, who write for the New York Times and also teach at the University of Michigan. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thanks so much for having us.